It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today it's a strange 21st century anomaly. You can't cook, but you love to grill. Well, for the heartiest of the hearty, we have Grillmeister Steve Reichlin talking winter grilling, from shoveling out the Weber to dusting off George Foreman. The Stearns are in Louisiana at Robin's doing the crawfish and Tabasco ice cream thing. Bright Lights Big City guy Jay McInerney brings us the wine for lovers, pink champagne. On the flip side, T-man Bill Waddington talks a new trend, pairing tea with your dinner menu. Then it's a little Valentine seduction, Alice B. Toklas style, and we get the skinny on gin as perfume. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's what I think of as the non-cook's cooking, grilling. Now, there's no need to give up the grill because it's 10 below. Barbecue genius Stephen Reichland talks winter grilling, from shoveling out the Weber to dusting off good old George Foreman. Now, wine guy and novelist Jay McInerney has the wine for lovers, Pink Champagne. It's finally getting some respect. Teetotalers have a new gig, pairing foods with tea instead of wine. Tea expert Bill Waddington has the guide. Then it's peeping into a very private dinner. It's the 1920s, it's Paris, and it's the cook to Alice B. Toklas. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, please tell me you've been someplace warm. Huh? Please.
Oh, we have. And I know you're freezing to death, Lynn, so this will make you very jealous. We've been down in Henderson, Louisiana, and we've been at a restaurant which Michael and I always thought was called Robin's, but in fact it's called Robin's. That's the way they say it in Cajun country.
And when Jane said we've been someplace warm, in some ways she underestimates. We've been someplace very hot, as in spicy hot, because Robin's is not too far from the McElhaney's, where they make Tabasco sauce. And many of the restaurants there, including Robin's, take full advantage of Tabasco. Here's Robin telling us about some of the things he does with it.
The only thing I don't make here is French fries and ketchup. You know, we make everything else. We make our own tartar sauce. We make our own salad dressings. We make our own. And I make homemade ice creams is one of my loves. I love to make homemade ice cream. And, well, I have a unique flavor today that I made for Julia Childs when she came to visit the McElhaney's, which was fig preserve ice cream. And then I also have nutty coconut. I have a Tabasco ice cream. I think would be unique for you guys to taste.
And if a person comes to this restaurant to eat crawfish, what kind can they get?
What kind of crawfish can they get? They can get crawfish etouffee, crawfish bisque, fried crawfish, crawfish boulettes, crawfish bell pepper, crawfish gumbo. God, I mean, crawfish we can cook anyway, but on a stick.
It sounds like you could have a McElhenney sundae with crawfish on it.
I'm sure Robin would make it for you if you asked for it.
When Mr. Robin said he had Tabasco ice cream, the first thing that came to my mind was this has to be the most disgusting thing I've ever heard of, except for lobster ice cream that Michael and I once ate in Bar Harbor, Maine. But in fact, it is quite good. It's kind of like, I don't know, when you were in Italy, Lynn, if you had chocolate chili gelato, but it's an interesting sweet spicy mix, and it's actually quite delicious after Cajun food.
But really, to talk about ice cream when we're discussing Robin's is it should be parenthetical, because the great thing to eat there is crawfish. This is crawfish country. Robin has perfected ways of freezing the crawfish during crawfish season, so he's got it on the menu year-round. And his crawfish etouffee is probably, well, maybe one of the top three I've eaten in that part of the world. And, of course, that's the part of the world where it's a significant dish. I have to just tell you, we've known Robin's restaurant for actually more than 20 years. I mean, we met him shortly after he opened it, I think back in the late 1970s. And this place has remained absolutely true to its mission in life, which is to serve great Cajun food. I mean, pure, true Cajun food.
You know, and if you go to New Orleans and you eat at Emeril's or you eat at Paul Prudhomme's place or, you know, Court of the Three Sisters or any of the sort of big name New Orleans restaurants, it's such a dog and pony show to be there. It's such a big deal. But Robin's, in Henderson is a little teeny little dot of a town on the map. And Lionel Robin is just, a one guy show at this restaurant. And there's something so wonderful about eating the food that when, you don't feel like you're making a pilgrimage, mm-hmm. To the great culinary shrine.
And also it sounds like this is the food he's eating at home anyway. I mean, as opposed to
his food.
We've made it up sort of thing.
No. This is, you really get a sense, Tabasco ice cream aside, but you really get a sense that the stuff on this menu is part of who he is. It's his heritage. It's his culture. And eating at Robin's is an opportunity to partake of it.
I'm all toasty and warm, and I can't wait. Thanks, guys.
Oh, I know. You need a big sweater, Lynn.
I know.
Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Merci.
De rien.
When you see me there, I ain't no fool. I'm one smart Frenchman, never been to school. If you want to get somewhere in a Creole town, you start to let me show you your way around. You let the bounce down roule. You let the mule roule. Now don't you be no fool. You let the bounce down roule. I got a Creole gal with one fine dish.
The Stearns are authors of the now classic Road Food. Now, they're here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're roaming the site, don't miss signing up for our weekly newsletter. It's brought to you by the farmers of Organic Valley. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Every single week, we get you a new recipe for a fast supper dish, technique, and some shopping tips. And best of all, it's free. That's splendidtable.org. Writer Jay McInerney keeps trying something new, and each time he does, it wins acclaim. His portrait of city life and debauchery, Bright Lights, Big City, turned bestseller. His work for The New Yorker wins praise, and his wine writing for House and Garden magazine is a must-read, even for those who don't give a hoot about the grape. Jay, it's good to have you back.
Thank you, Lynn. Good to be back.
Jay, I want to talk to you about pink champagne. Now, I am a pushover. I think it is the most romantic wine you can serve, but I'm always a tad embarrassed about it. I mean, you're the wine expert. What's your take on pink champagne?
Well, it's funny. I think we all are a tad embarrassed about it, and I think this stems from our early experiences with so-called pink champagne, with a sort of fizzy, fruity concoction that California turned out in large quantities. That might have been the first thing we ever drank that fell into the broad category of wine. I think that as people learn more about wine, they feel that they have to renounce anything pink-colored. In fact, I think pink champagne is one of the great pleasures in life, and I particularly think of it for Valentine's Day. I guess the color is really one of the pleasures, but that's not to say that it's not a serious wine for the palate, and that's something that I think many wine drinkers don't realize. Some connoisseurs prefer pink champagne to the paler stuff, and in fact, it's a better accompaniment to food. It can be very, very serious, as in, for instance, Dom Perignon's celestially priced vintage dated rosé, but you don't have to spend $200 to get a really great bottle of pink champagne.
As a guy who
will sometimes order the 32 ounce sirloin, I'm still pleased to be able to recommend a wine that is my daughter's favorite color. It in fact goes quite well with heartier foods, and one of the pleasures of pink champagne, if you ever get a chance to sort of try more than one of them side by side, is the extraordinary range of colors, going from sort of very pale orange to a kind of very deep raspberry.
The color comes from what? How did you actually get the pink?
Well, there are two ways to make pink champagne. The simplest way is to simply add 10 to 15% of a red still wine to the base champagne. And that's what most makers do. A few very ambitious champagne makers use the method whereby the red grape skins are left in contact for a little while with the white juice underneath.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
A few places, Krug does this. They make a champagne that I heartily recommend if you have an extra $150 in your pocket.
So what are some, you mentioned we've got the $200, the $150, but what are some of your other recommendations?
Well, you can get a very good pink champagne in the sort of $30 category. Mm-hmm. One of my favorites is widely available in this country, Billicart Saumon. I find almost everyone I've ever served this wine to becomes a big fan. The larger houses, Veuve Clicquot, makes a wonderful rosé champagne or pink champagne, mm-hmm. as does Moët & Chandon. And that's probably the one that you'll see most often in your local liquor locker.
So you're talking $30 a bottle is the range in this?
Yeah, well, 30 up to, as I say, 200. But the one thing that's tough to find is a great $15 pink champagne. Although, if you are willing to go to California, for instance, Chandon makes a very nice example for about that price. Some people feel that champagne has to come from the Champagne region of France. And in fact, technically speaking, we shouldn't be calling California sparkling wine champagne.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I don't feel bad stepping up and asking for my pink champagne, but I guess if you can afford it, it'd be great to go broke. And if you can't, we now have an alternative. Jay, thank you.
My pleasure.
It was a bad, bad Valentine's night. They broke up on Valentine's night. She cried and cried, what's wrong, what's right? It was a bad, bad Valentine's night.
Well, Jay McInerney writes his wine column for House and Garden magazine. He's author of Bacchus and Me, Adventures in the Wine Cellar. You can find Jay's rosé champagne picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're thinking romance, you can't ignore America's favorite feel-good food, chocolate. Now, I've got a goof-proof recipe for you. It's really a brownie on steroids. It's fudgy, it's lush, it's called double chocolate excess. And the trick to the intense chocolate flavors is a mix of bittersweet and unsweet chocolate. Well, speaking of baking chocolate, Chris Kimball, who's the editor of Cook's Illustrated magazine, told me something interesting. He said when experts did blind tastings of brownies made with very expensive dark chocolate, you know, that's more bitter than sweet, and with cheaper, sweeter brands, guess what won? The cheaper, sweeter brands, Calibo and Ghirardelli, were near the top. So even though the experts tell us we should all love those super bitter dark chocolates, you know what's stashed in the desk? It's milk chocolate. It's a Hershey bar. Anyway, to get the recipe for double chocolate excess, you can go to the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, winter grilling with barbecue genius Steve Reichlin, the new gig for teetotalers, and open lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. Americans have this weird take on grilling. I mean, all the time people say, I can't cook, but I love to grill. Now, if thinking grilling isn't cooking has you actually feeding yourself, I could care less how you got there. But then there is this weather thing. Winter. I mean, even the most manic grill jock or jockette goes back to the takeout counter when the wind chill drops below that big fat zero. But not the master of the coals, Stephen Reichlin. Stephen's latest grill tome is Barbecue USA. Hey, Stephen, welcome.
Hi, how are you?
All right. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, Stephen, I have to tell everybody that you live in Miami, right?
I do.
Okay.
And so winter grilling means something a little different here than it does up in Minnesota.
Can I ask you to just imagine snowdrifts, you know, and put yourself in that mindset?
Well, you know, I used to live in Boston, and every January and February, I'd chip the ice off my kettle grill and fire it up. So, you know, I know of what you speak. And more recently, I was teaching a class in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and it started snowing, and I had about 3 inches of snow during my class. So I have had some experience with cold weather grilling.
So how do you do it? I mean, can you grill when it's really stone cold out there? Is it possible?
Well, you can. And before you start, you need to determine what sort of person you are. Now, the key question here is, what do you shovel out first, the path to your car or the path to your grill? And in my circle, the true diehards shovel out the path to the grill.
Right.
If you're working on charcoal, you have it a little bit easier grilling in severe cold weather. Well, because charcoal burns hotter than gas. And you can get an inexpensive extra charcoal grill and do nothing but keep it full of lit coals. So you can replenish the coals, build up a really hot fire. In fact, I found up in Calgary during that snowstorm, we were probably averaging between 60 and 80% longer cooking time than would be, you know, in normal summertime weather.
Is it smarter to cook things that are thinner, things that cook faster, if you're working in the cold?
Well, of course, thinner foods do cook more quickly, but I was thinking of smoking, thinking of my beer can chickens, which I like to smoke with hickory chunks. And in that instance, you actually cover the grill, which helps in extreme cold weather.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that's really problematic, and I hear from folks all the time on my website about this, is people who like to do true smoking, true barbecue in the winter. Now, just to refresh your memory, smoking is an indirect method. It takes place at a much lower heat, let's say typically between 250 and 275 degrees. And the firebox is adjacent to, offset from the smoke chamber. And when it gets real cold, it's just virtually impossible to smoke in those sorts of circumstances.
Well, you know, what if outdoors really is just not an option? Can we get a similar effect by cooking inside?
Well, you can, and funny you should ask, Lynn, because the book I'm working on right now is a book on indoor grilling. And for me, that covers everything from grilling in your fireplace to using very new high-tech devices like contact grills, like the George Foreman grill or a panini machine.
Mm-hmm.
When one talks about grilling, some of these devices do work like outdoor grills. For example, a fireplace works like a wood-burning or charcoal-burning grill. A built-in grill of the Gen Air sort works like a gas grill. You have something called a freestanding grill, very often with an electric element. They don't tend to work terribly well. They tend to to be a little cool, but mm-hmm. you know, you can do grilling for one or two on those. And then you have what I would call pseudo grills, and those would be grill pans or the contact grill. Now, a grill pan is simply a skillet with raised ridges, and what it does is it lays on tack sharp parallel grill marks, which are, you know, in one sense, that's kind of one attribute of grilled food, that it has this these sort of zones of intense searing.
Right.
In fact, when a lot of people do food photography for magazines, they use grill pans instead of outdoor grills because you get such tack-sharp grill marks. Finally, the contact grill, you know, of the sort of the best-known example of that would be the George Foreman. It's sort of a giant waffle iron, but it has raised ridges like a grill pan rather than a waffle surface. And those devices can be useful. They're great for making sandwiches. They work very well for cooking seafood, fish, steaks, somewhat well for cooking meats and steaks. Mm-hmm.
Stephen, let's go back to the fireplace for a minute. Do you cook in the flames or do you cook in coals there the way you would normally cook, you know, outdoors?
What I do is I build a fire, a brisk fire of wood on one side of my fireplace, and then I rake the glowing embers under a gridiron. And the gridiron is simply a grate on four legs. So I actually do my grilling over embers, just like you would do in a charcoal grill. Advantage is you're actually grilling over wood, so you get much more interesting smoke flavors than you would with charcoal.
Well, Stephen, I'm going to be out there chopping wood. Hey, thanks a lot.
Well, happy grilling and stay warm.
Well, Stephen Reichlin is author of Barbecue USA. Now, you can get the perfect winter grilling recipe from Stephen. He has left us with green lightning shrimp. You can get it on the website, splendidtable.org.
Now this is serious. One thing in this country that really bothers me is the inability of Yanks to make a good cup of tea. Instructions are printed on the tea bag, but they either can't read or they think it's a gag. I mean, pour boiling water over the tea. How simple and clear can instructions be?
Tea merchant Bill Waddington has always been a man with a mission. Now, he became fascinated by tea early on, and he spent decades tracking teas to their source. He learns from the masters. Now, Bill created his shop, The Tea Source, in St. Paul, and he's been giving us an ongoing tea primer. Bill, it's good to have you back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
Okay, this time I got a question for you, right?
Okay.
More and more people are not drinking. And, you know, when everybody comes to dinner, it's a drag to just put out water for people or, you know, phony wines. Well, I'm sorry. Those phony wines are awful. They're ghastly. So how about teas?
I think teas work great as an accompaniment to various parts, to various courses of the meal. I think they're the perfect alternative.
So I can match teas just the way I might match wines, right?
Very similarly.
Okay. Can we play a game?
Absolutely.
All right. I'm going to come up with a dish, and will you tell me sort of the kind of tea I should have with it?
I'll give it my best shot.
I love this. All right. Okay. Pasta with tomato sauce, maybe a little on the spicy side. Big, robust, you know.
My first choice would be a black tea, I think. Either a black tea from Yunnan, which is in southwestern China, because they're the only black teas that naturally have a little spicy note in the tea itself. It's not like chai where you've added spices, but Yunnan teas have a tingle on their tongue. They're medium-bodied to full-bodied, so they aren't going to overpower the pasta. But that spiciness, I think, would accentuate the spiciness of the pasta dish.
Okay, so Yunnan black tea with the pasta.
Mm-hmm.
Pork, slow-roasted, flavored with rosemary and sage.
I think you need something pretty full-bodied to stand up to pork slow-roasted. My first choice would be either a tea from Assam in India, which is known for having a malty quality, a thickness to it, or a black tea from China called a Keemin, which almost has almost a chocolatey note to
it. Ooh, 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 that sounds wild.
It'd stand up to the pork, but they wouldn't overpower it, I think.
Bill, what about something really delicate, like, you know, a poached fish of some sort?
For a lighter fish, I would definitely go with a green tea, probably even be more specific, a Japanese green tea, because they just naturally have a taste of the sea to them.
I remember some of those teas. They're right. They taste like they're briny almost.
They really do.
Okay, now, dessert. Fudgy chocolate cake with gooey chocolate frosting.
One tea comes immediately to mind. It's a tea from Mauritius, which is an island in the Indian Ocean between Africa and India.
Right.
And they grow a lot of vanilla, but they grow a little bit of tea. And some of the tea actually picks up the flavor of the vanilla grown on the island itself, just through being grown in vanilla fields, being using vanilla husks as fertilizer. So it's a strong black tea with a little bit of a vanilla hint to it that I think would just be such a neat counterpoint to that strong chocolatey, fudgy flavor.
What a great conversation piece. Wow. Now, do all these teas have to be served piping hot?
Absolutely not. There are a lot of teas that actually, I think the flavor even improves as they cool down. Teas from Darjeeling, as an example, or Ceylon, or green teas, or oolongs, all of those can be marvelous as they cool. The flavor will change. Sometimes it'll get even a little bit lighter or a little bit thicker, but they're marvelous. So you can make them at the beginning of the meal to be served in the middle of the meal.
And could I put them in a carafe just to keep them tepid?
A lot of teas will work very well that way.
Ah, so I can do it ahead. Yeah. You know, Bill, all these teas sound pretty special, so we're going to have to go to a special tea shop, right?
Probably. You need to find a tea merchant who's going to probably have a good selection of teas, either at a shop or online.
Okay. Well, hey, thanks.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Tea expert Bill Waddington can be found at his shops, The Tea Source, in St. Paul, Minnesota. Novelist Monique Trong is fascinated with the lives of Alice B. Toklas and Gertrude Stein. In the Paris of the 1920s, these two Americans created a salon that brought together extraordinary talents, the likes of Picasso and Hemingway and Dos Passos. Well, Trong took a note in Alice B. Toklas' papers about advertising for a cook and having a Vietnamese man answer the ad. And she spun it into an imagined picture of their lives as seen through the eyes of that Vietnamese cook. The novel is The Book of Salt. Now, I want to let you know, this excerpt is sensuous in nature.
"24 figs, so ripe that their skins are split. A bottle of dry port wine. One duck. 12 hours. I make a mental list of the ingredients for the dinner that I will cook and that you and someone else will eat. I had pictured at least 6 or 8 in total, all of them young, all of them male, a smaller cross-section, perhaps, of those who congregate around Gertrude Stein during the Saturday teas. Tall saplings crowding around an earthy patch, they always seem to me. Of course, I notice them. They are my weekly bonus, after all. If I had known, I would have agreed to work for these madames for free. Money, I know, is not everything. Lust is an entirely different story. Thankfully, my madames provide me with a steady supply. Gertrude Stein and Miss Toklas prefer each other first and second, and then they prefer their messieurs, young and American. I would have never guessed that these two ladies, so uncompromisingly past their prime, could surround themselves with such glory. The figs and the port I will place in an earthenware jug to get to know each other, as my oldest brother would say. 12 hours will be sufficient for a long and productive meeting. By then the figs will be plump with wine, and the wine will be glistening with the honey flowing from the fruit. The port is then ready to be poured onto the duck, which should sit in a clay dish, the insides of which have darkened from years of sustained use. The duck is then placed in a hot oven for 1 hour and basted every 10 minutes or so, with spoonfuls of port that have grown heavy, with drippings and concentrated sugars. Before the wine reduces to nothingness, the figs are added, and just enough stock to evaporate and moisten the heat in the final moments of cooking. A clear consommé braced with laurel leaves and lemons will begin, and an almond soufflé spiked with orange flower water will end the meal. No, A tart is better. Apricots, maybe, though at this time of the year they would have to be dried. Pears, perhaps, would be best. You did say to keep the menu simple, especially the dessert. That, in fact, was about all that you said before hiring me. Simple. What an odd request, especially of a dessert. What sort of man does not hunger for richness and sweet at the end of a meal? Simple. Maybe you meant something that would be left unattended, something that I could leave for you to serve, to apportion at just the right moment. A souffle is most definitely out of the question. Too temperamental. A lover who dictates his own terms. A tart is better. Uncomplicated in the wrong hands, even a bit rough. Like an American boy, I would imagine. I will leave it cooling in the kitchen with a small bowl of creme fraiche alongside. Then, once the duck has been served, I will leave your garret for the night, for a cafe and a glass or two of something strong, very strong. And you and your someone else will be alone at last. My departure will signal that intimacy has joined the party. Civility has called it a night. You two can now dispense with the forks, knives, and spoons. Your hands will tear at an animal whose joints will know no resistance. Tiny seeds from heat-pregnant figs will insinuate themselves underneath your nails. You will be sure to notice and try to suck them out.
That was Monique Truong reading from her first novel, The Book of Salt. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. It's about romance. Flowers have always had meanings for lovers. But did you know that you can send a message with something as simple as lettuce? So the question is, what would lettuce mean to a lover? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be taking your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. The question was, what does lettuce mean to a lover? Now, you see, flowers have always had meanings. In Victorian times, people sent bouquets that could be read like a book. Nearly everything that grew had a meaning, including vegetables. So let's take a fresh pea salad with lettuce and almonds that's sprinkled with basil and marigold petals. Now, let me tell you what the message is. Peas mean departure or get out of my life. Lettuce gives the reason. It means cold-heartedness. Almonds back it up with stupidity. Basil wipes out any hope since it means hatred. And of course, marigold petals represent a vulgar mind. Just think, you can say all this with a salad bowl. You never have to open your mouth.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender.
The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. All right, let's get right to those phones. We have got Kathy on the line. Hey, Kathy, what do you want to talk about?
Well, I harvested some lavender flowers and dried them last summer, and now I'd like to know, what should I do with them?
I love that scent. Are they really aromatic?
Yes, very, very.
Ah. You mean, what do you want to do with them in terms of cooking, I would gather,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Well, you know, one of the great things to do with anything dried, and especially something like lavender, mm-hmm. is to make an infusion, you know, almost make a tea. The same way you would make tea where you warm a liquid. But the trick is, you warm the liquid, but the liquid might be cream, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put the lavender in there, you warm it gently, and then you just cover it and let it sit for about 30 minutes, and then you strain out the lavender. And so if it's milk or if it's cream or if it's even cooked down white wine, you're going to get this lovely lavender flavor and scent, because lavender tastes lovely. And, of course, the aroma is great. One thing that would be great, because the trick with these flower aromas especially is you don't want to cook them to death.
No, they're still delicate.
Exactly. And what I'm thinking is, are you familiar with the dessert panna cotta?
No, I'm not.
Okay, what it means, it's an Italian dessert. And technically, it means cooked cream. But what it really is the idea that you warm cream and sugar together, literally to make it just warm enough to melt gelatin.
Okay.
And then you blend that with some sour cream, and you have vanilla in it usually, and it could put vanilla ice cream out of business.
Oh,
I believe so. Yeah, so this is what I think you might want to do. Let's make a lavender panna cotta, and then you can sprinkle some of the flowers over the top of it. And the basic formula, I carry this around because it is my all-time favorite easy dessert, and people just weep when they eat it from joy. Take, it's about 3 cups of heavy cream, 1/2 cup of sugar, 1 pinch of salt, all right? And then you want to have started out by taking about 1 1/2 to 1 3/4 teaspoons of plain gelatin and letting it soak in about 2 tablespoons of cold water. Because you know how gelatin kind of spreads out and becomes, almost looks like a creature.
Yes.
So what you do is put the 3 cups of cream, 1/2 cup of sugar, a pinch of salt into the saucepan with about 4 tablespoons of lavender flowers and warm that very, very gently. You could put in a little bit of vanilla, but you really, I'd say stir in the lavender as the cream starts to get warm and see if you get a really distinctive smell, because you may want to add more lavender.
Mm-hmm.
Cover it, set it aside for about 30 minutes. Then what I would do is strain it, warm it in the saucepan again, melt in the gelatin, and then add 1 cup of sour cream to that, whisk it all up, and then chill it.
Wow.
And you can scoop it out on a plate, or you can do it in individual ramekins, and people can just dip into it. And I decorate it with a little few buds of lavender.
Oh, wow. It sounds terrific.
Oh, it'll be fabulous.
Well, it sounds delicious.
Oh,
I'll probably be harvesting more next year.
Oh, this is great.
Oh,
hey,
yes.
Thanks for calling, Kathy.
Thank you.
You take care.
Bye.
We got a message from Philip in Washington, and this is an interesting message because the season is a-coming. He is looking for tips on how to shell fava beans because it's incredibly laborious. Well, it's really not the shelling of the beans I think he's talking about. It's the peeling of them. Now, let me explain what fava beans are. First of all, fava beans taste like nothing on earth. I adore them, absolutely adore them. Come spring, fresh fava beans are available all over the Mediterranean. They're as common as, you know, onions. And you're seeing a lot of them in the markets in the United States. Their pods are big and long and green. And when you open them up, it's almost as though everything has been nestled in cotton batting. There's a fibrous material inside. It's very cushy. And you'll see these green sort of, almost look like little lima beans, green beans. Now, you can eat them if they're very small and they're young. You don't have to peel the little skin on the outside of the bean. It's quite tender, and you could cook them with the skin or you can eat them raw. One great tradition is fresh sheep cheese in the spring, which is when you find the best fresh sheep cheese and fava, and you have a hunk of bread and a little coarse salt on the beans, and that's lunch. It's a shepherd's lunch. Well, when you get the bigger fava beans, those beans are large and they should be peeled. And this, it's tedious, but this is the best way I've found to do it. You shell all your beans, you get a big pot of water boiling, you drop in the beans, you let it come to a boil, okay, for maybe 30 seconds, drain them, rinse them with cold water, and then you sit there. And you just squeeze those beans, and the skin remains in your finger, and the beans kind of pop out. And yes, it's tedious, but this is a great thing for the kids to do for you. This is one of the reasons why children were created. Reach us, 800-537-5252. Let's see now. We've got Robert calling from Oklahoma City. Hey, Robert, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, I'd like to talk about red bananas.
Red bananas.
Yes, I thought they were the pink-meated variety like I got when I was on Guam in the service, and I bought a bunch of them, and they more resemble miniature plantains. Dark reddish skin, but the meat is white, but it's very solid.
And it's not an underripe banana.
It's not an underripe banana, no, because I've now had them sitting there about 3 or 4 days, and they've not got soft at all.
Nothing has happened to these things.
And they don't peel like a regular banana.
Oh, yeah, I think you do have plantains, and plantains and bananas come from the same family of plants.
Right.
And there's more forms of each one of those than you can shake a stick at. But generally, check me if I'm right, a plantain generally is not going to be as sweet.
They always have to be cooked.
Yeah.
And but these red ones, the plantains are, again, twice as long as these. These are about 6 inches long.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can understand, because I've seen those little red bananas, and they're normally as sweet as sugar.
Well, that's what I thought I bought, but when I got home, that isn't what I had.
Yeah, but you know what you can do now. You can do fried plantain chips. And this is the food of gods.
Okay.
The thing is, with plantains, if you think of them as potatoes,
mm-hmm.
You're home free,
because
you can steam them, you can boil them, you can mash them. They're fabulous with spices. And what's wonderful about plantains, too, is if you steam them or boil them, and if you can't get the peel off, you can actually just try to cut them into chunks and, you know, simmer them gently until they're soft, and then you can just ease the peel off. But if you mash that and then you top it with a really spicy stew or a curry of shrimp, you will think you've died and gone to heaven. But for the fries, what you want to do is thin slice them. And some people put them in ice water just to draw out, I think, some of the moisture or whatever, and then pat them dry. But the reality is what you really want is good flavored fat, and you drop them in that fat and you crisp them. And it takes 3 minutes, you know, 375 degrees. You can also put them in any kind of batter, like a tempura batter is fabulous. But that is what you can do with plantains, and they're just a big treat. You know, what you can do with a potato, you can do with a plantain. I think plantains taste fabulous.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that.
You are welcome. Thanks for an interesting question.
Okay. Thank you.
You take care, Robert.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Well, you can reach us, 800-537-5252. We got a message from Adam, who was calling from New Hampshire, and I thought it was an interesting question. He wanted to know, can you pair wine with dark chocolate? And the answer is absolutely 100% yes. It should be sweet, it should be red, it should be rich, and it should be complex. And all of that spells port, Okay. And tawny port being, I think, the most exciting, kind of the sexiest to go with chocolate. And there's great buys in port coming out of South Africa, coming out of Australia, coming out of California. You can go online, look at sites like the Wine Spectator and other wine sites to find some names. The other wine that's great with dark chocolate is a wine that comes from the Quady, that's Q-U-A-D-Y, folks, in California. And by the way, they make ports. They make this red wine called Elysium. And it's done with the black Muscat grape. It is sensational with chocolate. Anyway, thanks a lot for a great question, Adam, in New Hampshire. And I hope this helps you out. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. We've got Lola on the line, and Lola is calling from Nashville, Tennessee, where I am imagining it's warm. Tell me it's warm there, please.
Well, let's see. The thermometer on my door says 54, but it's been in the sun.
Oh, but still, you know, it's so cold here, I don't even want to tell you how cold it is. Hey, did you have a question?
I did. I had dinner in a Tibetan restaurant in Somerville, Massachusetts last year, and we had after dinner hot buttered tea.
Oh.
It's a Tibetan, I don't know what, I mean, it had a cloudy look. I assume that it had some kind of milk in it, but
right.
It had a thin layer of butter on the top, which was probably yak butter.
Uh-huh.
But it was delicious.
Was it salty? A little salty?
A little salty, yeah.
Uh-huh. Yep. There's a whole family of these kinds of things. Chai. Tea,
yes.
Which you've probably seen advertised.
Oh, I drink it all the time.
Right. Well, that's a sort of another take on this. It's in tea-producing areas or areas where tea is a basic drink. These drinks of milk and tea cooked together, and in this case, butter, are very popular. Now, in Tibet, from what I understand, I mean, this is something people drink all day. And what it consists of is black tea, often tea grown in Tibet, but you could use any black China tea or a black Ceylon tea, for instance. And there's milk in it, and there's butter, yak butter there, but you could use butter here.
I can get yak butter here.
You can?
Yes.
You know, at this point, isn't it remarkable what's happened to food?
It is.
I mean, we could get anything. Well, yak butter and then a bit of salt. And this is drunk all day. And if you think about the climate in Tibet, it is high, dry, and this is real sustenance. And in winter when it's cold, this has got to be, you know, it's great.
Fabulous.
So you cook the tea. Now, I've heard that they will actually simmer tea, water, and black tea for hours. I don't know if, I mean, that can make a pretty strong mixture. But the idea is that you want to start out with a black tea. And that's what's in most tea bags, by the way.
Right.
And you brew it relatively strong. And you take the tea bag out, or you take the tea out, and then you mix it with butter and milk. And you if you have 2 cups of tea, you want about a half a cup of milk. And then you want maybe a quarter of a cup of butter or a little bit less, and then salt to taste. And you heat that up and you serve it very hot. And what people do in Tibet is they actually churn it. You know, they have something that's like a churn where you could beat it or you froth it in a blender.
Huh.
And, you know, you get that together and the butter goes in and you froth it up and you just salt to taste. And you drink that piping hot on a cold day and it's going to be fabulous.
Oh, it was such a treat. It was a very cold night.
Yeah, and it would be, and it's something that a lot of people shy away from because they hear salt in tea and it, you know, and butter, and
butter,
it sounds weird, but it's
crazy,
but it's fabulous. Hey, thanks. This is introducing a new drink to everybody.
Wonderful.
Take care.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us, guys, 800-537-5252. You know, I've always thought paying real money to smell like a fruit bowl was kind of odd. You know, the business about banana hand lotion, cantaloupe soap. Well, guess what? Now you can smell like a martini. The Bombay Sapphire Gin folks have created a new fragrance called Infusion. Now, Bombay Gin is made by the Bacardi Company, and we have Jose Chow, who is Vice President of Travel Marketing for Bacardi, on the phone. Jose, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, you have to admit, isn't this a little odd, gin perfume? How does this work?
Well, it may seem a little odd, but in reality, what we were seeking to do was to communicate what makes Bombay Sapphire so special. And what makes it so special is the blending of 10 botanicals that is the essence of Bombay Sapphire.
Uh-huh.
So that's where the whole thing started.
So what does it smell like, actually?
It really smells great. It's really clean. It's fresh. Using the language of the people in the fragrance business, the dry down is outstanding.
What does that mean?
Very contemporary. That means that after your initial spray,
yeah,
and it dries,
uh-huh,
what does it really smell like?
Oh, well, I see what you mean. Yeah.
So that sense, as you know, when you buy a perfume and you spray yourself, they always tell you to wait a little bit,
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm,
your body will interact with that scent, and you know your chemicals will give off different smells depending on the person.
Right.
In our case, the dry down comes off as being very fresh, very refreshing, as a matter of fact, very clean.
So you don't smell necessarily like the bottle of gin?
Not at all.
Okay.
That was never the intent, believe me when I tell you.
All right, but why a perfume? There's so many ways to do a brand extension with something like, you know, the gin. Why perfume?
Well, when we sat down with a design agency in London, And I proposed to them the challenge of coming out with a really unique approach. That agency came back to me with the notion of, why not a fragrance? Fragrances, the world over, are made up of different botanicals that are blended together,
uh-huh,
so that they come up with a unique composition. For example, Chanel uses orris as their base product,
uh-huh,
to create Chanel No. 5.
Yeah, that's a root. Yeah.
That's a root.
Yeah,
well, we use orris as one of the botanicals that makes up the unique taste of Bombay Sapphire. So that's where the link really came in. So when the gentleman came back to me with, why don't we create a scent, my first reaction was like yours. I don't want anybody smelling like gin. So the challenge was to really come up with something unique that we could offer as part of a promotional offer, mm-hmm, in the duty-free channel exclusively. We did not want to see this necessarily as a standalone fragrance that we would sell in the open market.
So this is only in duty-free shops?
This is only in duty-free shops, and it only is available as part of a gift pack.
It's an original idea, Jose. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Lynn. And I hope the next time you go overseas that you look for it. It's really exciting.
I'll give it a spritz. Take care.
Thank you. Take care.
Jose Chow is Vice President of Travel Marketing for Bacardi. Well, that's the show for this week, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And let me leave you with this thought until next week. I mean, we were talking about scent. There's this old French proverb, garlic is the vanilla of Provence. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Be sure and take a look at our weekly newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. You can register for it on the site. It's easy, it's fun, and best of all, it's free. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Judy Graham. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week. Join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.